This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 116, Monster Bash.
Hello, everyone. This is Phaedra Boinodiris. Welcome to another episode of GamesAtWork.biz. I am joined here by Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, the co-hosts of the show. Hi, guys.
Hey, Phaedra. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. We've got a great show for you today. Michael, you want to go ahead and introduce our guest?
Absolutely. It's a very exciting show that we have today because we have a pair of guests online with the three of us today. We have Eric Mertens. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And we have Aaron Camerata. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, gang. How are you?
Oh, we're doing great. And I think the best way to kind of get a sense of who you guys are and what you have done and why this is a very appropriate show for you guys to be on.
And how you snuck into the show.
So Eric, can we start with you? Can you please give us a little bit of your background and your work with Aaron, and then we'll go to Aaron next.
Yeah, sure. I'm Eric. I've been working in software research and development for over a decade now. I kind of specialize in functional programming and tools for program correctness. My kind of recent projects, I do things in kind of network operating system and mobile security. And I worked in particular on the game we're going to talk about today and some of the verification aspects. And we'll learn, I imagine, more about what that means over the course of time.
Awesome, Eric. Thank you. So, Aaron, how about you?
Yes. So I'm the loose cannon on the deck. My name is Aaron Camerata. I've been developing games, as a passion since I was probably 8 years old, when my uncle taught me to program on a Timex Sinclair 1000 with the membrane keyboard. And I've always had a passion for games, in particular their ability to kind of bring you into a new world that exists only because, you know, somebody brought it around. I have found over my career that I kind of drifted towards what you might call serious games, games with a purpose, and most recently found myself working alongside Eric and the rest of the team on the crowdsourced formal verification project. My background and education is in computer science, so I definitely am a lover of technology, but I really enjoy bringing entertainment and even entertainment with a purpose, making that where I sort of specialize.
Oh man, Timex Sinclair, that was my first computer too, and I wrote my first game on it. I called it Drunk Driving, the game of getting home after a good party.
Oh, nice.
And it was basically, I was trying to figure out how to do mazes and just move a pixel, actually it was a cube, through a maze. And every once in a while I had a random number generator that would jump things in front of you,
mm-hmm.
right? And you'd have to swerve. And then I had a random number generator in your WASD keys. So you would try to hit A and it would hit W instead. So that would be the aspect.
Oh, nice.
So that game probably didn't last very long when you played it, did it?
Well, it was only for local enjoyment, and I was not of the age to be imbibing yet.
I was going to say, when I was writing on it,
I wanted a Timex.
I wouldn't have known what drunk driving was, but
that's right. And I think like many years later, like within the last 5-8 years, somebody actually came out with a similar game that's like a race car game.
Yeah, isn't it? Was it Desert Drive, or what was the one that you get 1 point for driving all the way to Las Vegas from California?
Oh, that one was not about drunk driving though. But
no,
it was, yes,
no.
I remember that. It was a real time simulator. Like, it literally took like 6 or 8 hours. You just
exactly.
sit there holding
and,
W,
and you have to make sure that you drive all the way. And they do this
right.
now for charity. It's Penn and Teller's game. Well, we'll find that before too long, because it's just a riot that, you know, you drive all the way to Las Vegas and you get 1 point if you don't run off the road. Speaking a little more seriously, and maybe some of the reasons why we're here all together, talk to us a little bit about this crowdsourced formal verification project. How'd you guys get wrapped up in this, and how did you kind of click yourself into Monster Proof as a way to contribute to that project?
Sure. The core problem, and your audience can check out the sort of DARPA program page, but the core problem is one of bandwidth. Basically, being able to do formal verification at scale changed the way that software is made more secure. And Personally, this is Aaron on the game side. I was the game designer on Monster Proof and Stormbound before that, and I got involved because I had at a prior company worked with DARPA on another project, on a simulation project. So just sort of through that world, caught wind of this project, and it was really fascinating to see not only the idea that games could be used to perform some needed real world task, but also they had a clear idea of a way to kind of put rubber on the road, meaning it wasn't just an abstract, you know, thought like, hey, wouldn't it be neat if it was, no, here's a problem, we want it solved, let's give it a shot. So that was our side. And then I believe, Eric, on your side, it's just sort of more in your wheelhouse, is that right?
Yeah, so this is the kind of project that's right up our alley, the company I'm at now. So we're always doing things we can to improve software correctness, to exclude kinds of errors. And the opportunity to bring more people in to a kind of specialized field, kind of structuring it as a game, seemed like a great way just to advance our kind of overall goals for software in general. The goal isn't for us just to be the ones doing it, but to make it approachable to anybody.
It's interesting because one of the things that I saw out at the RSA conference, I guess it was about a month and a half ago now, was the Cyber Patriot initiative that was doing some really interesting things to get to teach kids about online security and some programming aspects, et cetera. And they were using some game aspects too. So
yeah, right. There's definitely an increase in interest in the whole space. So I think it's not a surprise that you're finding ancillary and related things, you know, coming up.
So as you guys kind of got started with this, you know, looking at the game as it's structured right now, I love kind of the snarky attitude of of the early tutorial lessons, at least, right? Mm-hmm. What made you go down that path, right, to get people engaged in the gaming aspect before we get into more of the kind of the back off, you know, the back end, the verification aspect?
Or even how did you come up with that particular design? Like, how did you choose, based on what you wanted to do with the game, how did you choose the kind of design you ended up with?
Mm-hmm. Sure. This, just by way of perspective, and I'm not sure how familiar your audience will be. This was a 3-year project, and we're in the second phase of it. There were 5 games released in the first phase, and then 5 released in the second phase. So the answer to your question is a little bit longer. It was an iterative process. We did, you know, Stormbound in phase 1, and that was, if you think of the spectrum of sort of game design as a function of utility. I argued as the sort of game design purist towards hiding completely the math problem that underlied the game. And I have hoisted my upon that petard. It's over. Give up. That to completely abstract away the problem, basically made it extremely hard to get any traction, especially as a player, to know whether what you were doing was any good. In Monster Proof, we kind of took that lever and slammed it all to the other side. And so how, you know, getting to your question, how did we arrive at this? Eric and the team at Galois sort of took a prototype of what they wanted it to feel like. What would be an effective tool for reasoning about software? And we on the game side worked alongside them to understand the cognitive tasks and insights going on inside of the, you know, of the expert's mind, and then kind of went back to our drawing table and said, well, what the insight that you need is that there's a piece of information. So how can we craft a game that would lead the player to think about the problem in an analogous way, and then hopefully let them grasp the puzzle enough that they say, wait, there's a piece missing right here. And we'll kind of get into that when we talk about details. Part of your sort of answer or is maybe how did we arrive at the sort of snarky Joey, the medieval monsters. And that's interesting. It came up from some early sketches. We had a concept artist here working on different tones and themes. And one of them was actually originally atoms. It was going to look like these atomic figures, like a nucleus and electrons spinning around. And he had stuck some eyes on them because, hey, googly eyes, right?
Of course.
And we said, this is awesome. People, everyone that we showed concepts to, they all went to cute characters. Okay, we're going to go with cute. So the atomic concept didn't work, but we were able to go to the sort of monster theme. And we can talk what monsters do functionally in the game, but it gave a sense of character and a sense of place. And again, people just sort of responded to it.
When you were first thinking about the problem, what kinds of games did you have in your library that you were looking at? Like, did you have a bunch of casual games up on your laptops and on your mobile devices thinking, okay, you know, this kind of an experience, you know, should it be more strategy? Should it be more this, that, the other? Like, how did you go about matching up the kind of experience with, and I know you were really trying to go up several levels and abstract the problem. Mm-hmm. How did you go about eventually landing on what you ended up landing on?
In, you know, again, from the game side, my goal is to drive an engagement, make it mm-hmm. you know, enjoyable, purely enjoyable. And in Monster Proof, the way we got there was that there is a prototype that Eric and his partner, in particular, a gentleman named Yavor, the two of them wrote a prototype that we on the game side played. And we played and played, and at first our eyeballs bled. And then eventually we got to the point where we said, ah, that felt good. I solved that puzzle. And if you've ever if you've ever solved a Sudoku the first time that you grok why that was the answer and you found it, it's rewarding. In this case, we said, what real world sort of analog exists that this is similar to? And Sudoku is kind of a touch point that we keep going back to. If you play Monster Proof, hopefully it shares that meta property of, I know what's missing, I know why it's missing, and I put it in, and then you get a green check mark, and it's rewarding.
I would say, just for some inspiration for why we thought this could work, and where we kind of got the idea to really expose the player to kind of the nitty-gritty details, I think one of the biggest inspirations for me is actually some of the games from Zachtronics. You may know of this company. They make games where you build circuits or where you write assembly programs under these very tight constraints, and then the players compete to make the smallest possible game or the smallest possible circuit. And you give people all the details and you just let them go crazy and you give them a high score list and you see what they can come up with. And for some of the verification tasks we have, we don't know what the right answer is, but we do have a kind of a sense of what a good answer is or a better answer is. And so if we can encourage players to optimize that and feel like they're in control and they have the tools they need, we're really hoping we can just kind of take advantage of that competitive spirit and just individual intuitions for what's going on.
So Eric, did you have sort of a target age group that you were aiming for that, you know, lend itself for this kind of instantiation and the monster metaphor that you're using?
People probably between high school and my age in particular. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess I should say I'm like 30 now.
Which one's like 29, right? And 19.
Yeah. So in particular,
narrow casting.
I mean, we wanted to have the math to not be, we didn't want the concepts themselves to be challenging, but to provide, you know, simple enough math that we can break things down to, but with enough kind of possibilities that it's, you know, there's different answers that people come up with. So we don't want there to be a high barrier to entry in terms of who can understand the math, but right, there is a certain probably class of player who is more interested in that kind of that challenge rather than less action and more puzzle mentality of a game.
Well, I like the way that you construed the challenges more as puzzles, and I like the representation, the algebraic substitution of, you know, dragons or fairies or, you know, whatever in the game to represent variables in the puzzle that could then be used to do the verification, right? Because you're trying to do, you know, transitive properties, substitutions, equivalencies, and by virtue of finding where there's faults and there's not a path from A to B in the code, you're able to represent that in a game structure where people could have fun testing it and locate those paths that were not complete.
And you remind me just one more, another inspiration. There's an iPad called Dragonbot that teaches algebra. and I've got a 5-year-old at home that I've that game to and watched him play and learn just playing with monsters as variables, kind of had dots as numbers, and wow, he really picked up on it fast. And just kind of if you can construct that game in a way that doesn't look like homework and looks fun and interesting, I feel like we'll just be able to bring more people in. It certainly worked well, at least at home.
Well, it's interesting to see, you know, those games where you're optimizing, you're solving for X, for lack of a better term, kind of lending itself to this design. I'm wondering if pen testing would be like a castle defense or tower defense game.
Yeah, we did look at a sort of a tower defense. And again, since there's a need to be more than entertaining, that utility is the primary sort of success metric, it didn't quite work. There wasn't enough complexity, if you will. But we definitely thought that's sort of a way to go. And if I can sidebar on Dragon Box, there's a sort of an interesting anecdote. Do you have a minute or so for that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're huge fans. My kids love it too.
As do mine. Yep.
Right. So this project began, as I mentioned, 3 years ago. So my son was 6 at the time, and he had just finished Dragon Box. And I was so amazed at the level of internalization of the concept that I gave him, while he was brushing his teeth, I gave him a question, which I don't remember the details, but it was like, you know, at Winnie the Pooh's birthday party, if Eeyore brought so many cupcakes and Christopher Robin added so many more and three other, and it was an algebra problem, you know, 3x plus 7 or something, then how many did Piglet bring? And he, you know, spit out his toothpaste and said 4, and it was right. And I was like,
awesome.
You've got to be kidding me. And it turns out that...
And Eeyore was still upset about it, though.
And Eeyore got none, and he's, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. but the interesting thing is, there's a gentleman who was also on the crowdsourced formal verification project, a man named Zoran Popovich. He was the designer behind Foldit, which I believe you've referenced as well before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes. I mean, it's like being in the room with, you know, this is the guy who sort of invented and first reduced to practice the idea. And he and I got into an argument because he said, well, it's not really teaching you algebra. And I turned around and I said, well, my son just did this. and I was like, what am I doing? And then he showed me how he was right, of course, but it's still fascinating to see this kind of stuff going on. Yeah.
So you didn't retort and throw back and fold. It's not really solving science.
Well, it would have kind of been equivalent to saying, "No, Mr. Jobs, the iPhone is stupid. I don't care how much you made off of." You know, it's like
I want a dial.
You know, it's just, you realize you're going uphill and you just stop.
like, couldn't you almost
back down?
Flip the idea now on its head too, and say, "Well, we're doing verification testing as a game. Why couldn't new code creation be done as a game?"
Oh,
ooh.
Wow, you took it. yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, you know, it feels like the next logical step here could be, I'm going to create some tough problems relating variables one to another, and by crowdsourcing the game enough.
There was a story on NPR, I think it was like 2-3 days ago, talking about a computer algorithm that was developed that could solve come up with its own predictions to solve certain scientific problems.
Oh, and then wouldn't it develop an experiment to test a hypothesis?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right. So we would give it that. We would allow it to program itself, and then I will be welcoming our robot overlords.
and I, for one, that's right.
Yes.
To your question of computer programming as a game, it's fairly actively a game. There's a number of websites, say Rosalind.info, where they have algorithms they have you program up, and you submit the program as your solution. They've got various coding competitions. I think Top Coder either did or does run one. There's actually a lot of math challenge problems online people do, and they compete for the shortest answer.
Right.
Yeah. There really is. And there's, have you played Elevator Saga? I just put that link
no,
in.
No.
Yeah. So just sort of more support. It's a very simple JavaScript style. You program elevators to move people up and down, and you have to get the concept of, well, do I just cycle through the floors one at a time? Or it's kind of wild.
Oh,
I'm definitely going to have to look into that. There's an elevator bank in a building in Bratislava where I was stuck waiting for the elevator banks to go take me to the necessary floor because it was Easter Sunday and the elevators had a holiday schedule in this office building. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you don't want to work them too hard.
It's like I didn't realize that elevators got a holiday too, but I guess I definitely have to have a look at this because I know exactly who I want to email it to because the developer of this property and others, I complained bitterly to him about the algorithms used in those elevators. He's like, oh man, we spent all this code on getting those elevators to work optimally.
Oh, wow. And you know, you bring up an interesting point about the computers coding themselves, but there's an interesting possible side effect to games like Monster Proof. And it's something that we've been talking a lot about internally about almost as sort of training a new generation of people who will do formal verification or helping discover them, like go back to, you know, Starfighter, right? It's sort of like, hey, I'm really good at this game. And that translates to I'm actually quite good at reasoning about properties of correctness about source code. And therefore, I actually might have a career in this. So we don't know if that'll pan out, and it's not a stated, but it's just one of those when we're sitting around at 6:30 after work kind of, huh, that's interesting.
I just have to ask the question, did you use any kind of test automation to test Monster Proof, or was that handled through a crowdsourcing testing, sort of a meta version of testing via crowdsourcing, as a piece of software that tests via crowdsourcing?
Oh, gosh. I think you're, I feel like I'm stuck in a recursive loop here.
Go to 10.
Yeah, exact 20. Go to 10. No, we didn't turn it upon itself this time around. We used sort of more standard testing systems and suites.
Looping back, since we're looping anyway on the humor front, I had just one other piece on this that I love the bits that you inserted in there. I love the Ben Stein bit. I loved these other elements, and you'll discover them when you play them. So don't have to give it all away. Did you find that using humor was something that you did A/B testing on and recognized that it brought higher engagement levels? Was it a reflection of your personality, or where and how did you decide to use for higher levels of engagement in the game?
Definitely B. It was my, personality coming out a little bit. Just it wasn't boiled down. And actually, so you touched something that could be a complete other show: A/B testing and metrics and sort of their purpose and use in the industry. I'm of an old school designer. I kind of feel like it's sort of our job to curate the experience and not to put it out there and A/B test everything to death. It's the pendulum is swinging a little too far. One way, but and Joey is just me goofing, and I think what happened was that I started showing it to people, and not only did they chuckle at the right points, but they understood the game better. So if there was any A/B testing, it was really more about comprehension and sort of grokking it. But they also did sort of express that it made it more palatable. A little bit of sugar helped the medicine go down.
Very cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Knowing what you've know now, and having had the experience that you have, are there things that you would do differently if you were to kind of teleport yourself? Well, you don't teleport, but if you were to go and time travel back to where you were going through the original submission, what would you do differently now?
Oh man, Eric, do you have anything on that? I'm gonna have to think on that one. That's a great question.
Well, I could say it's a little bit that in the beginning we really did start from this notion of hiding as much as possible and kind of relying on the player to somehow develop an intuition without giving them any handholds to really grab onto. Mm-hmm. and hoping they see patterns or hoping they see, something that we don't. And over the course of the project, we really moved towards getting them exposed to more and more detail and making them feel like they could actually directly reason about what was going on. So we probably could have saved a lot of time and maybe even gotten farther along if we started really focusing on giving the player a simplified but still as much kind of information, make it a puzzle as much as possible and less a kind of pattern matching game. So there's just some time we could have saved there probably. But I don't want all program verification to go through these games. I just want this to be a teaser to get people excited and interested and feel like they can do it.
Yeah, it's almost like thinking from a standpoint of, learning strategy is important and how you learn it is great, but if it's based off of Go or chess, doesn't really matter.
Right, and from the point of view of the game, we did put in some sense of feedback. If you look in Monster Proof, it kind of gives you a sense of approximately you know, how many lines of code you particularly helped to contribute towards, you know, the verification of and the entire community. So we're trying to play up the sort of citizen science aspect of it and make it a little more public.
I had a great conversation. You mentioned Zoran a few minutes ago. I had a great conversation with him right after he made his big press release with Foldit. And I called him up and I said, hey, what is it like to be rich and famous? And he said, you know, my phone's been ringing off the hook with all these VCs and pharma companies calling me. And he said, so I decided to do a little test and I put the logo of a pharma company up on the game's website and everybody stopped playing. So he said for him, it was a big lesson to always remember the reason why people are playing. And in his case, it was really for altruism. You know, you're going to go and play this game in order to cure cancer, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I was curious. And I'm curious in general with regards to how much you reveal and then just making sure that you relay the right kind of message to the end user and always remember why they're playing. So just it was a lesson for me for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you guys fans of Dan Ariely, the author?
Of course.
Yeah,
sure.
So you're referencing exactly what he talks about, right? It's that if I ask you to do something out of the goodness of your heart and you choose to do it, and then you find out that I've been paying someone else, or you or then I offer you money and it's less than you're used to making, it triggers a different neural pathway. And it's definitely a sensitive and interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, for those reasons, I like playing Waze, and I use that term directly, right? When I use Waze, I'm a player, and I'm contributing to the collective good of the whole. And now that I'm being marketed to, which is not terribly aggressively, but it's starting to get there, I'm wondering about that just a smidge.
So when I stopped using Waze, to be honest, every time I went to a red light, a pop-up ad would show.
Oh, yuck.
No.
Well, it's a money-making...
And it would disappear once the car started moving again, right? So you're, you know, it's not a distraction factor. It's just like, really? I'm already providing you value by giving you traffic information, maps, you know, adding to maps back in the day, which doesn't happen very often anymore, et cetera. Now you want to do ads to be on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So right on.
Mm-hmm.
But there could be something that begins to emerge here in relatively short order where I'll use the title of our podcast, you might be playing games at work for fun and profit, where that is part of your job.
Exactly.
And the game is, in that sense, a tool to accomplish your job in a faster, more efficient way. And I think under those circumstances, there's absolutely, Fader, to your original question before, a very direct bright line connection that says, yes, we recognize it's an attention economy. In this attention economy, you're being compensated directly for playing the game that you are because it's creating value for whatever concern it, you know, it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Project Bookie. You got it.
Yeah.
The foundation of all this.
Yeah.
For us, at least.
Yeah. I'll throw another book reference in since you're bringing up attention economy and the whole free-to-play world. The Curve by, I would say, Nicholas Lowell. I will look it up. He talks about the ways in which the economy is shifting. It's no longer a limited supply situation, right? It's how do I both give and receive value and try to build my product in such a way that that's always a pleasant exchange in both directions. And so in the case of Waze, you know, I think your point was really valid. It's, hey, I'm already giving you real-time data. I've paid my price of my entry fee. You know, putting ads was now you're just ringing me here. So,
it's kind of like, you know, we've talked about this before on the show, you know, the freemium game model is okay when you understand it's you're going to pay as you play to speed up time. And if you have plenty of time to waste, you don't pay. But the pay me game where you pay for the game and then they add freemium into it to get additional content is kind of that same contract being broken, right?
Social contracts. Yeah. Hey, you know, before we switch gears, because we have a couple other, you know, things that we had added to talk about today, you know, Eric, Aaron, between the two of you, is there anything we should have asked you that we didn't, or something you'd want to share about what's coming next, or, you know, things you're wrestling with here that you might want to use this audience for crowdsourced help as well?
Interesting. I would love to see your audience continue a discussion around almost Phaedra's question before. I'm actually maybe getting that wrong already, but what, you know, sort of what other crowdsourcing problems might map? You know, if we opened the gates a little bit wider and thought more broadly about the idea of taking a problem and crowdsourcing it, you know, whether it be into games or some other thing, it's an interesting discussion. And I think it's something that's not going away, right? We're starting to prove concepts, and it's going to be, it may be the way the entire economy goes, being able to offload pieces of a problem.
If you had your druthers, what would you focus on? What do you think is a good match, a really good match for a crowdsourcing game? What kind of problem?
You know, I am a bad person to ask because I make games. Like, I would want to ask that of a physician or a politician or a scientist, you know?
Yeah, a funny story. I was asked by the press once, is there a topic that a serious game would not be a good match for? And at the time, this was a few years ago, and at the time I was, you know, struggling. I'm like, okay, maybe a game that helps a country balance its budget. And then lo and behold, like the next day, there was some announcement about a budget balancing game that came out. So it's, I can understand it's a difficult question, but there's a lot of interest, I think, because of DARPA's investments in biopharma. Certainly seems to be a hot spot. Tagging, meta tagging. How do you use crowdsourcing games in order to gather metadata? Because that seems to be a major pain point that could solve some big problems. So, just some things I've heard.
Yeah, I think the ones that probably, and I'll call it the genre, right, or the domain, would be any game around social good, right? Because it's easy for people to understand that and want to contribute to that, versus, you know, ones that have just an obvious financial linkage. Right.
That's a good point.
So if you think about one of the things that I found interesting about the Cyber Patriot program was, you know, helping kids understand safety and privacy online. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's a societal good thing. Right. Even though they were also helping them understand how to do like pen testing and understanding, you know, how to set up and configure security software. Right. So the social good aspect tends to trump when it comes to the space where people want to really engage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Michael, I think we're just about out of time, even though we had a couple other links, and we can put those in the show notes if we want for people.
Yeah, I think you're right. We'll keep them listed there, but you're right. We are right at time. So maybe the best way we can focus our concluding comments here is to ask what you guys are playing. So, Eric, what games are you playing right now?
Oh, well, one of the Zachtronics games, actually. There's a new early access game on Steam called TIS 100. It's an assembly language programming game, and it's right up my alley. And when I'm not doing that or in the background, I'm playing EVE Online.
Oh. Boy, have we got a podcast for you. That's awesome.
It's interesting. I remember, you know, EVE Online's been around for a long time, and that is all the whole, you know, political aspects of that, of, you know, building the policies and building up the groups inside of that is just phenomenal. I haven't gotten into EVE. I play way too many other MMORPGs. But I know people that play it like crazy. So good to hear another one.
Mm-hmm. And I tend to be real interested in the sort of the title pool and backwaters of games. And so I'm playing Sailor's Dream on iOS. I don't know if you've played that at all. It's a real evocative sort of puzzle game. Another one called Framed, which was by some industry vets who kind of branched off, sort of nonlinear storytelling. And then I also kind of like, there's one called Slingshot Braves. And then I have to out myself that in general, my son and I just picked up, oh God, I can't believe I'm going to actually say it, Magic the Gathering.
Oh no.
After this long as a game designer, I said, I got to start playing. And of course, I'm completely hooked and in awe of what they've done in terms of changing a design over 20 years and so on. But that's taken up a bit of time. So good, fun stuff.
Too cool. Yeah.
What are you playing?
I've started getting back into Hearthstone. Which is Magic, but by Blizzard. and yes. Still haven't spent the dime on it. So that always makes me feel good. I spend plenty with WoW.
So Phaedra, what are you playing these days?
I noticed that Grim Fandango has been remastered. So I remember playing the original version, and I launched into that with my kids, too, so they could get a sense as to what it was like. It's not bad. They did a good job. Do you guys remember the original?
I got to throw one more shout-out. Knights of Pen and Paper. It's like an RPG. If you guys ever played Dungeons & Dragons, Knights of Pen and Paper plus one is a killer remake, so to say, CRPG. But yes, definitely I remember Grim Fandango. Yeah, I'll get that.
Well, thanks, everybody. And if you would, leave us a comment or rate us on iTunes or track us on all the various and sundry places. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks again for the guys for being on the show.
Okay, have a great one, guys. Take care.
Great, thank you. See ya.
Bye.